Welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh, a place to chow down on topics relevant to writers of all kinds.
Hello, and welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh. I'm Marissa, and this is a weekly podcast in which I talk about a wide variety of writing-related topics, usually by myself, but sometimes I have a guest, which is the case for this week's episode. A few nights ago, I spoke to Andy Mascola, a writer I've followed for some time on Twitter via Skype. Andy's latest novel, Where Are You Now, Randy Dow, is available on Amazon. I've been reading it and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It was great talking to Andy, and I think you'll find a lot of what he has to say interesting. So, with no further ado, here's my conversation with Andy. Enjoy. So my guest today is Andy Mascola. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
That's Mascola.
Mascola, okay. Is the author of the novels Kissing Oblivion, Animal Control, Paper Bag Revolver, and Who's Afraid of the Virgin Wolves, among others. Andy's newest book is titled Where Are You Now, Randy Dow, and it is currently available for purchase in both paperback and ebook editions worldwide via Amazon. Andy is also a senior writer for the music blog Surviving the Golden Age and the host of the People Are the Enemy podcast. Andy, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. As I was just saying, I've been reading your book, Where Are You Now, Randy Dow. I haven't gotten that far into it yet, but so far I'm really impressed by what you wrote. I guess I'll start, though, by asking, how did you first become interested in writing, just in general writing?
Oh, okay, that's a great question. Well, in general writing, you know, I was encouraged by a teacher. It must have been in junior high. I think I wrote a short story, and I just remember a teacher telling me, you know, you're really good at this. This might be something that you want to think about doing either for fun on a regular basis or even possibly, you know, studying in college after you graduate high school. And at that point, I was encouraged. I'd always been a reader. I've always loved to read. I still love to read. I may love reading more than I love writing. A buddy of mine once told me, he said, you know, I think maybe it was Stephen King who said this. He said, you know, as Stephen King once said, you know, once you start writing, you'll never want to read another book. And I've never felt that way. I've always felt like I love to write stories. I'm proud of the stories I write, but I have to keep a book going. Even when I'm editing my own stuff, I'm always reading something. But as far as the writing is concerned, that was the initial impetus was the encouragement from, I think, probably a junior high school teacher who really liked a story I'd written, or it might have even been in high school. But anyway, I've always enjoyed writing short stories, you know, just for more for my own sake. And I kept a blog for a number of years when blogging was popular.
Right.
And I'd let a few co-workers read it, and I had a co-worker who really liked what I was writing, because I'd read some fiction on my blog, and he said, you know, there's this thing called National Novel Writing Month that takes place every November, and it might be something that you want to try.
Hmm.
And I said, well, what do I have to do? And he said, well, it's free to sign up. The idea is that November 1st, you set out with the intention of writing, getting at least a 50,000 word manuscript done
between
November 1st and the last day of November. And he said, now you're a married guy, so you're probably going to have to tell your wife that you're going to be hammering away at this manuscript in the evenings, and that you may be indisposed. And I said, okay, well, I'll think about it. And so I thought about it, and I said, maybe this is something I could do. So I think it was think it was either November of 2008 or November of 2009, perhaps, maybe November 2009, that I did National Novel Writing Month for the first time, and I completed a 50,000 word manuscript, and I was pleased with it. But what happened is, after I completed it, I think it was the very next month, I lost my job, or I was laid off, and I couldn't do anything else with the manuscript, because all my time was spent, as I said, I have a wife and a family and a household here.
Right.
So I had to spend all my time looking for a new job. And so for 5 hours a day, every day, I was working the phones. And this was 2009, 2010, around the time that everything crashed around our ears, if you remember correctly.
Yeah.
You know, as the economy was concerned, and it was real, real hard to get my foot in the door. Just to even get an interview. But eventually I landed a job, and as soon as I started working again, I thought, well, now would be a good time to maybe pick up that old manuscript and see if I've got something here that's worth sharing with the rest of the world. And I started editing the book in my car on my lunch breaks at my job.
Wow.
I'd literally go out to my car with a pencil and the manuscript, and read it over and over and over again, and mark off, places I wanted to change or add things, or grammatical mistakes or punctuation mistakes or adding punctuation. And I did this. I worked it like crazy during the day at my full-time job, on my lunch breaks and on my regular breaks, just in my car. Remember, it was the winter, so it was,
that's amazing.
I was bundled up. I live in New England.
Yeah.
But I became really passionate about the story, and initially I thought, like, I'll just publish this under a pseudonym and nobody will ever know it's me. But I'd worked so hard on it and eventually just fell in love with it and thought, I'm really proud of this, and I do want to share it with the world, and I'm going to use my own name because this may be the only time I ever do anything like this.
Yeah.
And if I'm that proud of it, then why not put my own name on it? So that book became my first book, Unmagnificent Lives, that came out in 2010.
Wow.
And then what happened was, do you want me to keep going, Marissa? Because I don't mind.
Please.
To tell you.
Okay, please, sure. Go on. I love hearing this. This is just great what you're saying.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, okay, I've told the story a million times, so.
That, I haven't heard it yet, and, I'm very intrigued.
Okay. Anyway, so what ended up happening then, Marissa, was, a few people bought the book, which was nice and complimentary, and I was on social media, so I used that to promote it. But who am I? And it was a first book, so, and it was independently published. I did it through Amazon's CreateSpace profile,
right,
or platform, rather, as a lot of independent authors do. And so it did what it did. And I didn't think any too much else of it afterward, until about 3 years later, when a fella contacted me who had read my book and had moved to my city, which is Nashua, New Hampshire, which is where I'm located.
Okay.
And said, hey, I read your book on Magnificent Lives, and I really liked it, and I'm thinking of doing National Novel Writing Month this year, and that was 2013. And he said, would you be interested in partnering up with me so we can kind of encourage each other? And I thought to myself, well, I did it once, and I thought maybe I could do it again. So I said, okay, let's do that. Let's get together. So we met up at the library. And it was nice to meet somebody who read my book and who also loved to read and loved novels and knew a lot of authors, so we could talk. We had a lot in common right off the bat. And what we did was we made a plan to do National Novel Writing Month together. And I worked in another friend of mine who was also an English major. And I said, maybe my other friend would like to try too, so it could be the three of us doing it simultaneously. And what we do is we would get together at the YMCA in my city every weekend and discuss what we'd worked on that week for our manuscripts for National Novel Writing Month in that month of November. And what ended up happening is the other two fellas didn't end up completing a manuscript in the month of November, but I did again. And again, I was happy with what I'd come up with. And again, I just started editing it after the first of that year. And I got really, really, really obsessive with the second novel, strangely. It was an odd thing. That book became Who's Afraid of the Virgin Wolves?
Yeah.
And it's very strange, and it's very, very adult, I should say. the premise is very adult. You know, it's a gang of teenagers who basically they like to have sex with automobiles, which is kind of...
That's interesting.
Very strange, right? Of course. But this is kind of what was intriguing me at the time. I'd seen a documentary about these men, only men, of course, it would only be men who would do something like this, for, who were doing this. And I thought, like, what if there was like a gang of children who were, well, not children, but teenagers, you know, who were engaged in this sort of behavior, and just, you know, that it would just infuriate the police, you know?
Yeah.
That would be such a great premise for a story. Anyway, what happened was this book I just became obsessed with it, and this hasn't happened with any of my other novels, Marissa, but it was to the point where, like, I'd wake up at like 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and I'd be thinking about, and mind you, this was, you know, a 50,000 plus word manuscript. I'd just be obsessing on like one comma in like one sentence, one paragraph in the middle of this damn book. And I just start like pacing around my bedroom while my wife was asleep. You know, I had to be real quiet.
Yeah.
Just thinking about like, do I keep this comma or do I take it out? You know? And I was like, this is insane. This is insane behavior. Nobody does this. I thought, maybe this is something. Maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe this book is really good. Or maybe it's just maybe I'm just, you know, I don't know. I didn't understand why it had become so obsessive to me. I don't have any inclination to make love to an automobile. It's not like that. The story has nothing to do with anything with me personally, like, you know, the kinks or anything like that. Regardless, what happened was I ended up editing the thing to death until I felt like it was as good as it could be. And then what I did was I put it out into the world, and I ended up getting my first royalty check after that.
Nice.
Because a lot of folks were intrigued by it, especially given the unusual premise.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this is nice. It's nice to get a little reward. It wasn't much, but it was, you know, but it was, there was a legitimate check in my mailbox, and I thought, maybe I keep doing this, and maybe if I've done it twice, I could do this every single year. And, you know, maybe I could build a bibliography like the authors I love, you know, these ladies and men who have, you know, dedicated their lives to making these beautiful bibliographies of these wonderful stories. And maybe, and, you know, these stories that I read and I feel so good when I read and get a great feeling from, whether it's, you know, like a Kurt Vonnegut novel or a Sarah Vowell book or something, you know, and I thought to myself, like, if, you know, what if I created a bibliography like my heroes did? And after 10, 15, 20 years of doing this every year, I've got this beautiful little library created where somebody, maybe they'll fall in love with my books, and I'll be that voice that speaks to them, whether I'm telling a story about teenagers who make love to cars or, you know, an 11-year-old girl who is watching her recently divorced mom act crazy, you know. And that's become my path since 2013. And so here we are, it's 2020. I just put out my eighth book, which is, as you mentioned, Where Are You Now, Randy Dow. Anyway, that's kind of how I got into this.
That is really fascinating. I'm really glad you told me about that. I think there's a lot that you said that a lot of people will find helpful. I was probably going to ask you this later, but since you brought it up, I'm thinking of when you were talking about getting up in the middle of the night and working in your car in your lunch hour. You have a lot of stuff going on. How do you manage to fit writing in with everything else? Like, how do you prioritize? What do you think is the best way to do that?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, after doing this year after year, I've got a definite schedule laid out for myself. As I mentioned, I hammer out a 50,000 word plus, 50,000 plus word manuscript in the month of November. Now is the time after putting a book out. I call this the incubation period, where I kind of just open myself up to the universe and let whatever comes in come in, and I write down as many ideas as I can for the upcoming National Novel Writing Month of November. So in November, my pattern has been that I take the month of November. I eat a lot of Halloween candy. My wife knows to like save extra Halloween candy because I'll be writing every night. I'll pound a lot of Halloween candy, and I'll have my ideas. I usually sketch out where I plan to go with the story during the day that day, using the ideas and notes I've made. And I'll get a beginning, a middle, and an end, just like any good story has to have. And God willing, I'll finish by the end of November. I'll have a 50,000 word manuscript. And then what I do is I don't do anything for the month of December. I basically just kind of relax a bit and enjoy the holiday. And then on January 1st, I pick up that 50,000 word manuscript and I start to edit. And my pattern has been, I'll do 10 pages a night, and I'll go through every single night. I'll do 10 pages. Sometimes I work in the morning. If I only get 5 pages done in the morning, I'll do 5 pages at the end of that day, that work day. But I always try to do 10 pages a day.
That's good.
And I'll read that manuscript from beginning to end at least 12 times.
Wow.
Now you might say, why 12 times? Yeah. Doesn't that make you crazy? Yes, it makes you absolutely crazy. I'm a crazy person. But the reason it's 12, and maybe you know this, and maybe you read this book, but Stephen King has this book called On Writing.
Yes.
Have you ever read that?
That's
and
a good
in
one.
In that book, he said that he read each one of his manuscripts 12 times before he let anybody else read it. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for Stephen King, then, maybe it's good enough for me. So that's been my practice. And it takes the better part of the year to go through a 150, 160-page manuscript 12 times, just doing 10 pages a night. Yes, sometimes I take a night off, night or two off. Sure, that'll happen. But, when I've gone through it at least 12 times from beginning to end, and I'll keep track of it on a calendar. And mind you, each time I'm reading it, I'm making changes. Sometimes I'm pulling out huge chunks that I don't like. Sometimes I'm adding in big chunks. Sometimes I'm moving things around. Some nights I don't, I make very few changes, but you're always going to find continuity errors, especially with a manuscript that's written so quickly,
Yeah, yeah.
So it's going to be continuity errors, and my goal is to make the best story possible, and I always use the term bulletproof, to make it as bulletproof so that, when a reader reads it, they don't say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. I never want that to happen. I always want it to be as coherent as possible and to be as enjoyable as possible. And especially with a story that I'm going to have to spend the better part of the year with every single day, I want to love it just as much as I want the people who are reading my books to love it.
Exactly.
Anyway, so after the 12 times, at that point, I handed it off to my wife and I said, mate, and that's a strange experience. I don't know. You being a writer yourself, Marissa, when it goes from your own head in this thing that's lived in your own head for however long it's lived in your own head, to finally let somebody else kind of read it is just such a surreal thing, if only because you wonder, like, are they going to experience the same thing that I've experienced?
Exactly.
And especially living with something for as long as I do every year, and working it, you wonder if you've worked it to a point where only you understand it. You know what I mean? It's
yes.
A strange thing to say, but again, you want a story to be enjoyable, and I obviously want my stories to be as enjoyable as possible and comprehensive to the reader, obviously, and I don't want any errors. And then I'll let my wife read it, and then I'll start editing the ebook version, which is, as you know, if you've made an ebook, it's a completely different process.
It is, yes.
Paperback version is, and I'll be doing that, so that'll be like the 13th time I've gone through it.
Yeah.
So it's crazy, and then my wife will come back and she'll say, "Well, this doesn't. You might want to change this here, and I found this this error right here," and she'll mark up, you know, my manuscript, and I'll say, "Okay, great, this is exactly what I need you for." And there's also things, Marissa, and I'm sure being a lady, you understand this. If you've tried for writing from the opposite sex's perspective, that you question. Like I wrote a book called Wolfish Girl, and there was some sexual situations with this 20-something year old woman, and I thought, wow, well, I'm not a woman. I don't know what it's like to have sex as a woman. So I needed my wife's help for that. And
yeah.
I had to go through these scenes, or these explicit scenes, line by line, and say, is this accurate, or am I way off base? Because I don't know how a woman would express this sort of physicality.
Right.
And fortunately, I've been very fortunate. My wife is very patient. And unfortunately, you know, she's not a prude, so
yeah.
So she's she's been wonderful as far as helping in those situations. Obviously, with this most current book, where it's written from an 11-year-old girl's perspective, I didn't have to worry about any of this.
Getting inside a girl's head, I mean, especially that age, I mean, that can be difficult. Even
sure.
Me, if I was going to go back now and write something from an 11-year-old girl's perspective, and I actually was an 11-year-old girl, but I don't remember very much what that was like, I'd kind of have a hard time. So that's, yeah, I can totally understand that.
Yeah, it's enjoyable, I think. My last two books have been written from a woman's perspective. This one and the one prior, Now We Have Nothing, which was written from a woman pretending to be in her 60s, who was actually much, much older, not to give anything away. But yeah, that was it's enjoyable. It's kind of fun to slip into the skin of the opposite sex and explore what life like that is like, you know.
Exactly.
Because I've read plenty of books from a fella's perspective. I obviously want to try different things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to talk too much about me because I really want to hear what you have to say, but the book that I published last year, I'm single, so I don't have, you know, I don't have anybody really to read the manuscript before I publish it, but I was part of a writing group, and I would read scenes from my novel at the writing group before I published it, and my protagonist is a man, and a few people in the writing group had told me that, you know, when I was reading it, they weren't sure whether he was male or whether he was female or what. So I didn't totally understand what they were saying, because to me, I mean, he seemed like a pretty masculine, not like overly masculine, but masculine. But when people said that to me, I was like, wow, I really need to rethink that. So yeah, I totally get what you're saying.
I'm sure that you've experienced this yourself. I know I have, and I won't mention the authors, but I've read books where, like a female author will try to write dialogue for a man, and I'll say this doesn't ring to my ear from what I experienced in my own life. I don't think a fellow would come at the situation from this perspective or talk about this. And if it's again pertaining to something most especially of a sexual nature in particular.
Right.
I've run into situations where I've read other like female authors trying to write from a male perspective, and sometimes it doesn't feel real or true. And just the same from a fellow's perspective, a male author's perspective, writing a lady, I think, like, I don't know if a woman really do that. Maybe I'll run it by a lady friend or even my wife and say, is this real? Is this right?
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's, I think just like, you know, and just like with any sort of TV occupation that could be considered tedious, especially one that's so singular and such a solo experience where writing is, you know, done, you know, by the individual, usually not with a team, you know, that it's, you get bored and you have to try other things. You have to try to slip into other folks' skin, you know, and see what that's like.
Exactly. How do you find the experience of like self-publishing on Kindle and I guess, well, you could get the hard copies of your books through CreateSpaces. I don't know if they're still called CreateSpace. I think they changed it fairly recently. But I'm sorry?
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, they have changed it recently. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but yeah.
Oh, no, that's okay. How do you find, well, not just promoting, but just, you know, you mentioned doing a lot of revisions and finally getting it published and then putting it out there in the world. How do you deal with that? Because I don't know, publishing and then promoting your book seems like a lot of work to me, but it also seems like I'm kind of averse to self-promotion in some ways. Like, how do you do that? Do you have anybody help you with the promotion aspect, or is that still something that you pretty much do on your own?
Yeah, well, that's all done on my own. This last year was the first year I ever started participating in like a author events that
okay.
kind of take place for independent authors. I went to three different states last year, and I sold my books at these independent author events. Where I had a little table set up and I had my books and
oh, wow.
I got to speak. And I did this, of course, there were a bunch of other authors there. And this sort of thing is sometimes you have to pay for a table. And then sometimes it's offered for free, you know, like at a library, for instance. And I did a couple libraries and I did a show around Christmas time also. That was an interesting experience. I did okay. And, but yeah, it's not easy. I suppose you have to, I suppose I understand the aversion. I absolutely get it.
Yeah.
And this year will be the 10th year since I published my first book. And it was and last year was only the first year that I ever literally packed up a bag full of my own books and like a little sign and actually to a place and set it all up on a table. Like that to me was not something I was inclined to do and didn't feel completely natural right away. But I thought, like, if I really want to do this, if I really want to attract new readers and get myself out there, then this is probably a good next step. And especially where I've got I've accumulated accumulated 7 books, and I thought, like, that's not too shabby. You could stand there behind these little, you know, 7 stacks of your own books, and you know about each one of these, and you can talk about them. You know, I'm obviously telling myself this, psyching myself up, and like I said, it worked out okay. But yeah, it wasn't easy, and it's something if only I think that time has kind of pushed me toward. And all I could think was, when I started doing this, was that I thought, like, that if I continue to do this year in and year out, and I'm successful, I'm able to be successful as far as writing a story that I'm happy with enough to put out to the world and to publish independently or otherwise.
Right.
Then eventually I'll establish an audience and it'll be easier, and I won't necessarily have to shout it out from the rooftop, so to speak, as much. I can kind of, you know, rely on return business, so to speak, folks that have already read something of mine and hopefully loved it enough to say, well, I'll check out another one of this guy's books and see what he's got in store. It's only the last few books that I've started putting that other novels, you know, written by the author page in there. I don't know why I took so long to do it. My father was the one who actually recommended it. He said, you know, you've got, I think it was like after I put out 4 or 5 books, he said, why don't you have a page in the front that shows the other books you'd written?
Yeah.
And it was a weird thing, Marissa, but I always felt like, I always had like this weird kind of fantasy that somebody would just stumble upon one of my books.
Yeah, I've had that.
You know, say, oh, look at this, you know, and then think that they found something that was completely like, just like a diamond in the rough. You know, maybe that's giving myself too much credit, but just find something that, and just say, you know, and then eventually explore it a little bit and then find out that I'd had other things written. But I don't think that's reality. I think that's more just my fantasy.
I think that's titles. The way it is for me, definitely.
you put in another works page there so people can find your stuff, you know. So I've started doing that, but I think it's only kind of, and to be honest with you, it was also my father who kind of pushed me to say, hey, maybe you should start going to these independent writer events and set up a little table there. And I think my mother is a salesperson by nature, so I think that he thinks in these ways to market, you know. And,
that's
and,
awesome.
He provides a lot of advice and encouragement in that way. Whereas in my mind, I'm just thinking like, oh, I just want to create this beautiful little bibliography, and that maybe somebody will find it. But I don't think that's the reality. I think the reality is if you want people to read your stuff, you got to get out there a little bit. You got to kind of push people, and you got to kind of encourage them a little bit, and you know, you got to keep the price point right so that, you know, that somebody doesn't mind dropping $2 or $3 on a digital book from an author that they've never read before, you know.
Exactly.
That's important too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of times writers and other types of artists, they kind of have it, and I'm speaking from, you know, my own, I think that we kind of have this mindset that we're not good at selling ourselves, and that's not really what we do, and I don't think it's bad to learn how to do some of that. You know, you can learn how to sell yourself without being obnoxious about it, and that's something I'm still working on. But I think, I think a lot of times we have that mindset and we don't even really try to sell ourselves better than we do.
I don't know about you, Marissa, but I've never, anytime, you know, like a book is exceedingly popular and you'll hear advertisements, you know, and this doesn't happen as often these days, but, you know, in the days of, you know, terrestrial radio and stuff, you would hear advertisements for books on like a talk radio station or something like that. Or you just see advertisements in magazines for books. And anytime a book was super, super popular, I would kind of be turned off by it. Anything that was, I felt like was trying to get, I use this term like jammed down my throat. I'd just kind of be averse to it and kind of say, I'm not really interested in that. I'm going to go look at this other thing that is very odd.
Yeah.
seemingly singular, you know, in this used bookstore that, I use the term diamond in the rough, but sort of like finding like, you know, this special little thing, and you feel like you've come across this wonderful little gem that may have been overlooked, you know, and that you find this incredibly personal story that somebody has worked very, very hard on. And I suppose that's kind of what I've tried to mimic in my own writing, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know how you feel about it. Are you turned off when, like, a book like, you know, and I'll use this example. I don't mind using this example. I'm not going to offend anybody. But, like, 50 Shades of Grey was, like...
I've never read any of those books. I have never read any of them.
See, my wife bought the first one. And she read the first, I don't know, chapter or two. And she said, I hate this. I am not going to finish it. And then I looked at the thing and I said, you spent, what, like $15 on this thing. I'm going to have to read this book now because I feel obligated because you shelled out some cash for it. I literally sat down and read the damn book. I remember similarly, like, did you read the, what was the woman's, this is so bad, like Catching Fire and Mockingjay. What were those books?
The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games book.
I've never read the books, but I've seen the movies.
I remember, like, I think it was like an Entertainment Weekly came in our mailbox, and it had a picture of the Katniss character with Jennifer Lawrence as this, you know, I think it was her breakout role as this Katniss character.
Right.
And I had no idea what it was. I was like, what is this? And then I was in a TJ Maxx and I found the first book.
Oh, wow.
For like $3, and it was like a paperback, and I thought, like, and they had like a bunch of them. And I realized that they were probably doing this, they had probably, the publisher of that series, this kind of thing where they plant these books in these low-cost stores like TJ Maxx, where you find, you know, all this clearance items and discount items.
Right.
Hoping that somebody would drop $3 on a brand new paperback and fall in love with it and then read the rest of the series. And that's exactly what I did. I read that first book and then ended up tracking down the others at my library. It's just interesting how you come across things and find books. But obviously that was a hugely popular series, and I thought it was okay. It was all right.
Yeah, I like the movies. I would definitely be interested in one day reading the books because I did like the movies.
Yeah, they weren't too bad. Similarly, I remember Twilight. Like, remember how popular Twilight was?
Yeah.
I remember seeing, like, I think it was like a standee of that, the Edward character. I think it was that his name, the Robert Pattinson character.
I think so, yeah.
And I had no idea what this was. I was so out of touch. Because here I was just reading all these old books and whatnot, and I just said, what is this? And then I realized, I did a little research, and I said, oh, this is going to be huge. There's this whole contingent of young people who are just obsessed with these characters.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a gigantic film. And I thought, if I don't want to be completely out of the cultural loop, maybe I should check this out. And I ended up taking Twilight out of the library. I remember it. Our library had like 24 copies of it because it was just ridiculously popular.
Wow.
Yeah. And I took it home to my wife and I said, yeah, this is, they're making a movie out of this. I think it's going to be something, I think it might be big. And yeah, she ended up reading all those books. I read the first one and I was like, that's enough for me. And ended up reading the whole series. I don't know why I'm going on about this first.
I think this is fantastic.
It's interesting sometimes how you stumble across things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think especially with books, it's just, you know, so many of these franchises and there's these book series. I don't know. Have you ever had an interest in writing a series with the same characters?
I don't know if I could do something like that. I mean, the idea is intriguing, but like when I was part of a writing group, there were people in my group that did that. And I don't know. It's something I would definitely consider at some point.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever fallen in love with a character so much that I felt like, oh, I can't get this character's entire story in this one book. I need to kind of write a, you know, three or four volumes of it while starring the same character.
I have thought about possibly writing a sequel to something I've written before, but then there's that part of me that thinks, oh, sequels are cheesy, but then maybe they're not because people do series, so I don't know. I'm still, you know, still thinking about it.
Right?
Yeah.
How popular series are, like, you know, like the Suki Stackhouse novels.
Oh, yeah, I was talking about True Blood with somebody, the show. I haven't read any of those books either. I really need to read those.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. That's one series I've never read any of the books. I've seen the show, but I just remember seeing, like, the show was picking up steam, and somebody said, you know, these are all from the Suki Stackhouse novels.
Yeah.
And then I saw them all, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is, somebody's made a, you know, somebody's made an investment in time to create this character and all these characters and create this whole universe. It's impressive, but it's
yeah.
Something that I've ever been inclined to do. One thing I have done is I've kind of like had cameos of characters from my other books appear in my other books so that, I suppose I'm in my hope that readers will realize that, hey, this character is from this other book. And that's happened a couple times where somebody's reached out and said, hey, this person that kind of showed up in this weird little scene here, was that blah, blah from this book? And that's a really good feeling when somebody's done that. But that's as much as I've done. I haven't tried to, you know, write a series or write, you know, more than one story for one character.
That's really great though. That idea of previewing characters in other books, that's definitely a good idea too.
It's kind of fun. I know, like, Kurt Vonnegut did it a couple of times with a couple of his.
I love Vonnegut. He's one of my favorite writers.
Oh, I love Vonnegut too. Yeah, I think he had like Kilgore Trout appear like in another book, and I think Vonnegut appeared as himself in a couple of books too. Like, just, you know, like these weird little cameos. They're kind of fun.
Yeah, definitely. So, another thing I wanted to ask you about, I know you're really into music. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, writing for the music blog and also just the role of music, because I noticed that, one of the other books that you wrote that I looked at, I noticed you had a line from the Smiths at the very beginning, and the new book has a line from the Kinks, and, you know, obviously being very into music, what role would you say music plays in your writing? Is it like more of an inspiration, or is it something that you actually make in like a part of your writing? Just if you could go into that, I find that fascinating as well.
I think it's a little bit of both for sure. I think one of the things I love, and I can listen to two people argue about music for way more than most people, I think, would be able to tolerate, if only because, music is so, you know, people have so many opinions on music, and it's kind of silly when you think about people arguing about which band is better or which album's better when it's all, you know, it's all subjective, you know, everybody has their own tastes.
Yeah.
But to me, it's infinitely interesting to hear music being discussed and deconstructed. I write reviews, as you mentioned, for Surviving the Golden Age. I'm a senior writer there. I've done that since, I think, 2015.
That's cool.
5 years. But, and I love to write album reviews, and I love to listen to music, but I'm always conscious. Like, I'm always thinking to myself, well, this is just my opinion, but it's my hope that maybe if somebody reads a review, they'll say, even if it's a review of an album that I didn't care for, that they'll say, well, you know, this sounds like it would be absolutely something I love, even though this guy hated it. You know, I've myself have read album reviews of, you know, where the album has been completely trashed by a writer, and the way it's described is, I think to myself, yeah, that sounds like something I would actually like. I like drums that sound like, you know, tuna fish cans, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I like that singer that, you know, whatever, you know what I mean? Just something insulting. So I think reviews work both ways in terms of music, but I like to have my characters discuss music. I think it's an interesting part of everybody's personality, you know, and, you know, even though it's something that seems increasingly personal to people, for whatever reason, I have no problem asking people what kind of music they listen to, but you'll ask that sometimes, and sometimes people will say, oh, I like all kinds of music. And I know that's baloney, you know? You know, like, immediately it's baloney. It's like, why are you going to be fake with me? You know, that's like the worst answer you can give somebody, especially somebody who's passionate about music, is I like all kinds of music. It's like, well, can you get specific, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's an interesting part of a person's personality, and I have worked that into a lot of my stories. Animal Control, the book I wrote it's 2018. That I published in 2018 was about two brothers who form a band, and consistently they argue all the time, and the conflict for the stories, you know, conflict is built into these two characters who are struggling for success, almost like the Oasis brothers, if you remember, like Nolan and Liam Gallagher, who constantly fought, you know, and had these awful rows, even on stage, you know, at some points. And I thought, like, wouldn't it be a great story about two brothers who couldn't get their stuff together enough to get the band off the ground, but the band was really good, you know. And I wrote this story called Animal Control all about that. And that was a lot of fun to write, if only because I could put so much about music into it, you know,
right.
The story's background. And of course, there's the other bands that they come in contact with, and all these bands have their own personalities. It's just, to me, it's very, very interesting, and it's so personal. Music is such like an intimate experience and a personal experience. And I just, like I said, I love debate, musical, only musical debate, though. I don't care for much other debate, but again, even if it's superficial or silly, I still think it's always interesting to hear somebody talk about something they're extremely passionate about, and I think it's fun to kind of project that onto to characters, and it gives a little bit of insight into their kind of personality too, you know, for sure. I don't know if that answers your question.
I definitely agree. I mean, in the book that I published last year, these two characters that are originally enemies, they end up bonding because they're both huge Henry Rollins fans. So it's played a pretty big role in the books that I've written. How about for writing for the blog? I was looking at it yesterday, and I have to admit, I don't keep up with current music too much. Like, I saw Guided by Voices, there was something. I'm like, okay, I know them. And then I saw Throwing Muses put a new album out, and I'm like, oh, cool, they're still around. I think it's just Kristen Hirsch, though. They're not the Throwing Muses as I knew them when I was growing up. But otherwise, you know, following new music to me seems kind of intimidating because I know what I like. I knew what I grew up listening to. It's not that I'm closed-minded. It just seems like it's so overwhelming. Like, a lot of the bands that, you know, I listen to aren't around anymore. How do you find keeping up with newer music now? How do you deal with that?
It's definitely an investment in time. As far as I, you know, I'm very particular. I think it's probably because I'm in my mid 40s. I've been enjoying music since I was an adolescent. So I've listened to so much of it and heard so much that it's hard to kind of. I've heard it coined this way, that it's just harder and harder to like have something touch your soul like so deeply. You know.
Yeah, because, I think that's it.
Because you've experienced so much and heard so much, but so what tends to happen now is I really have to dig, and I really have to ask myself, you know, is this something that I feel like is wonderful and worth hearing again and again, or you know, or is this something that I'm interested in solely because it sounds like something I've already heard? You know, I think it's harder and harder to find music that touches that little spot in your heart that, you know, just makes you, you know, feel just, you know, absolutely happy to be alive, you know, just glad to be alive. It's just so, but I think part of the reason I continue to search for new music and listen to new music and read about new music and review new albums is because those moments where I found something, even whether I was 12 years old listening to terrestrial radio in my bedroom as a kid or with my cousin, or you know, whether I was, you know, 19 years old at a club and heard an amazing song that a DJ played that I'd never heard before, and it just, you know, the experience of being hearing a song and in a place where all your friends are and this wonderful feeling of newness and life, you know, that feeling is so intense that you search for it, I suppose, in the same way that somebody who searches for the next high searches for it, right?
Yeah.
You know, like a person addicted to an illicit drug would continue to get more and more into other harder drugs, if only to chase that same high. So I suppose that, you know, in all honesty, those moments are few and far between when I'm touched by something so profound that I just fall in love with it and listen to something obsessively for days or weeks on end during a year. That's a rarity, but when it does happen, it's just such a wonderful, wonderful feeling. Like, you feel like this connection to the world, and to you don't feel so damn alone. At least I don't. And I feel like a connection with things, and it makes you kind of walk around with your head up a little bit higher when you're walking down the street, knowing that there's somebody out there who kind of feels the same way you did, or can express something that maybe you weren't able to express in a song, you know. So I keep looking and I keep searching, and every year I manage to find albums that just bowl me over and make me feel alive and wonderful, fortunately, you know, that's still happening. I worry that there'll be a time when, you know, I won't want to listen to music, or I won't be able to listen to music. God, you know, I can't imagine like losing my hearing, you know.
Yeah.
But I dread that. It's that's constant fears that, you know, that what if these things that touch me so deeply no longer touch me, and I'm unable to find things that make me feel alive and not so alone anymore, then that's terrifying to me. But I think what I have to do in order to make sure that doesn't happen is I have to keep exploring and keep listening and keep reading and keep looking. And yeah, I listen, I do, you know, I'm on Bandcamp. I don't know if you've ever used Bandcamp, but it's been such a great resource to find all these independent artists and independent voices, people making music that, you know, may go slide under the radar, or may just be so odd that it wouldn't even be picked up on an algorithm on Spotify to send your way, as if it, you know, something that the algorithm would think that because you love Guided by Voices or because you love throwing muses that you might be interested in, but you find it anyway. It's been Bandcamp has been wonderful for that sort of thing. Obviously, it's great for the artist too, because they get paid through that service. And I'm happy to pay for an album through there, knowing that it's going directly to the artist, and I get this little magic package of wonderfulness, something, you know, this creative little thing that I wouldn't have otherwise maybe found on Pandora or Spotify. Not that I have anything against those services. I use Spotify too. I like Spotify too.
Yeah.
I found some interesting things through them also. Yeah. But, yeah. So I suppose, yeah, music is very, very important to me. So it's, but,
yeah,
I do love it, and it makes me feel great, and it's part of my life for sure. It's habitual, and of course it factors into my writing. I listen to music while I write. I don't know about you, but I can't listen to anything with lyrics while I write. I'll be distracted, even if it's something I've heard a million times. I still like am drawn to vocals, and I'll be distracted if I try to write while listening to something with vocals. But I'll listen to a lot of, find myself listening to a lot of music that I would not have otherwise heard, probably on a terrestrial station or something, where it's more geared towards, you know, pop music or rock music, for instance.
That's interesting that you brought that up, because that's actually a question I see on Twitter. People are asking, do you write while you listen to music, or do you write in silence, or what? So I think that's, I really need silence when I write. So I guess because I get so into music when I listen to it that it's hard for me to like concentrate on writing. I don't have that problem with art. Like if I'm drawing, I definitely will listen to music. But when I write, for some reason, I don't know. I haven't tried it so much listening to instrumentals. So maybe I should try instrumental sometime while I'm writing.
Yeah, I never really cared about jazz music until I started, you know, writing these manuscripts and editing them. And it's only because for me, it's again, instrumental music, jazz is, of course, unless you're listening to, you know, a jazz singer like Nina Simone, who's wonderful.
But, right.
You know, if you listen to just pure jazz, which is something that I do a lot of this, I'll go to, a Goodwill or I don't know if you have like a Savers where you are, but it's sort of like a giant thrift store, and I'll find old vinyl really cheap. And if I find an old jazz record, I'll buy that.
That's
because
cool.
I know I can put that on, and I can write or edit while I listen to that. And the other nice thing it does, and I know I've talked about this too, I think I've maybe talked about it on my own podcast, is that when you play vinyl, you know, you can listen for 20 minutes, but then you gotta get up and you gotta flip the record over.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of important too, to stop what you're doing and kind of walk away from your writing for a second. And when I'm listening to records, I find that like it kind of forces you to stand up and walk away from your words for a moment. Maybe you walk to the record player and you flip the record over, and on the way back you get a great idea for the next sentence, you know, or something. You know, kind of gives you that, it forces you to kind of pause. And I kind of like that. It's sort of like free writing. Like I don't know if you do that, but my friend does that a lot, and it's not something that I've done often. I've done it for my podcast with like monologues and whatnot, where I'll take pen to paper. But do you find yourself, Marissa, like when you're writing a manuscript or working on a story, that you'll freehand it, or will you use a laptop primarily?
I still write freehand.
You prefer it?
Yeah, I do like my first drafts on laptops more and more now these days, but I still always felt a connection between the page with holding the pen and things like that. And sometimes it's harder for me sitting in front of a laptop coming up with what I want to say. And like sometimes I'll write something on a page and I won't use any of it, but just the thought of like sitting there and holding the pen and staring at that blank page and just starting to scribble stuff really helps me come up with ideas. So yeah, I do like that, and I do miss that as I find myself using my laptop more and more.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because I know you're also a big reader and you've read a lot of the same authors I have. Do you prefer to read a physical book, or do you not mind reading on a tablet device?
I still prefer physical books. I have been reading more from tablets. It is easier. It's more convenient in a lot of ways. Also, I can highlight there and not like ruin the pages like I did with because I like to, I'm a highlighter. I try not to highlight like every word like I did when I was in college sometimes, but I do like to underline or highlight, and I've ruined a few books that way. And you know, Kindle, I can do that, and it's nice and neat. I'm not like ruining anything, so I'm starting to like that a little more, but I still prefer books. I just like holding them in my hands. I like new book smell. I still prefer that.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found that, you know, since the advent of the smartphone, what I'll do is, rather than, I've never been one to mark up a book, I don't know, it was just
that's
something
good.
I was taught. It may be good, but I think it's also, you know, I've also read, I'll tell you in all honesty, like, Camus, The Stranger, I don't know if you've ever read
Stranger. That's one of my favorite books of all time.
Marissa, I found a copy of The Stranger, and I think it was like, I think I paid like, maybe 50 cents for it in a used bookstore in northern New Hampshire, paperback, and it was completely marked up. And the notes were phenomenal. And the experience I had reading this book with all the notations, the handwritten notations from whoever had this book prior to myself. And I think the copy was maybe like the version that came out in the 70s, I think.
That's awesome.
It completely changed the experience for me, and the book, it blew my mind. It was such an engrossing experience and eye-opening, and there were so many things I think I may have overlooked otherwise had the book not been notated by hand by the last person. So I think there's definitely something to that. But I was going to say that the experience that I've had, you know, when I've found myself reading something that I love, or see a sentence that I loved, or a paragraph that I love, is all, and again, thanks to the advent of technology and the convenience of having a smartphone on my person at all times, I'll take a photo. I'll take a photo of the actual page, like in my lap, and then I'll maybe put it on Twitter and say, hey, check this out. I thought this was kind of interesting.
That's
cool. Or just save the photo so I can refer to it later, and rather than, mark up a book, especially if it's a library book. Do you find yourself going to the library a lot, Marissa?
I was before the pandemic, we'll put it that way.
Oh, sure.
They're open now, but I don't go out that much.
Sure. Are you leery about that? Is that what it is? It's a little concern as far as contamination.
It's Florida in general. We have not handled the pandemic that well down here. And
no,
Stephen King, I think Stephen King, he's been very critical of the Florida governor. And
Yes. And who else has? Ooh, there's another writer who has also, I can't remember his name now. Oh, man, I just heard an interview with this guy, and he's a Florida writer. but I know he writes for a local paper there in Florida as well as writing novels, and he's been critical of DeSantis also. And yeah. It's so strange. I always think, like, if I know another state's governor's name, he's probably doing, or she's probably doing, a horrible job.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. It's sort of like a, you know, like, I wish I could remember who this author was that I've heard interviewed on NPR recently, because he just put out this book, and he was talking about DeSantis, and it was interesting.
Not that there's anything good about a pandemic, I want to make that clear, but this isolation, I don't mind staying home and, like, reading and watching films and doing stuff like that. I'm not one of these people that, like, is like, oh, I can't stand being home anymore. That's not me.
So. Yeah, I'll tell you, I feel similarly. You know, when all the sports were canceled, I was like, that's all right with me. I don't mind. I'm not watching these sports, you know. Not paying attention to anything. I don't miss going to a baseball game, because it's nothing I'd ever done regularly in the past anyways.
Yeah.
I completely concur. I had this feeling like all my favorite things are indoors, you know, whether it's movies or books or, yeah. But I unlike yourself, I do use our library regularly, and it's they were kind of shut down for a bit initially with the pandemic, but they've reopened, and they've got a wonderful system where they're very, very cautious, to the point where if you bring a book back to our library, they will not check it in for, I think, like 3 or 4 days, just to make sure it's completely,
that's good,
you know, anything that be on the outside of the book is completely killed off before they, yeah, it's, they're very very careful. And of course, they, you know, they have the screens up and everything, as far as when you go there in person, and you can't go back into the stacks. There's only certain areas that you're allowed to go to. And yeah, they're being very, very careful, but,
that's really, yeah, good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. I enjoy it. I enjoy the library for sure.
Well, the Largo Public Library, which is near where I live, that did get the reputation best library in Florida, I think, for a few years in a row. I think it might have been last year, but there is a good library down here. So we do have good libraries. I mean, Florida kind of has a reputation, but, you know, we do have really good resources. It's just right now, this isn't the best place to be.
You know, you hear so many crazy stories about Florida. And I'd heard that it has something to do with it being a peninsula. Have you ever heard that before?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, that's definitely something to consider. I haven't really heard that before, but I mean, that's, I can understand that. I think also it's the transient nature. Like, a lot of people who are from Florida are originally not from here. Some people just move down here and then they're gone within a few years, or in even months some cases. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting stick.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it's been great talking to you. You're a really good guest. And,
thank you so much. I'm glad I could be a good guest for you.
What would you like to plug before you go? Like, obviously the book, Where Are You Now, Randy Dow, and, anything else you'd just like to mention?
Well, yeah. Where Are You Now, Randy Dow, is my latest book. If you love to read, if you're looking for something with a little bit of humor and a lot of heart, then I'd recommend checking it out. If you delve further into the books I've written, I've dabbled in a few different genres, including suspense and horror. You can check those out. Other titles of mine, and everything's on Amazon. If you look me up, my name is Andy Mascola. And if you don't use Amazon, you can find most of my paperbacks at barnesandnoble.com.
Oh, that's good to know. I will. I'm going to be putting a link in the notes of this podcast, so people know where to find you. But that's really great. I I hope I can get a lot of people interested in, because like I said, I'm really liking what I'm reading so
oh,
far.
Oh, good. I'm glad you are. That makes me feel so good, and that you took the time to download the book and read it as much as you have, Marissa, makes me feel wonderful. That's so heartening. I appreciate it. I honestly do. Oh, and I should say, if you look me up on social media, my preferred social media is Twitter. I'm at Andy Mascola on Twitter. That's where I spend a lot of time.
It's where I found you.
Yeah, that's where we found each other. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show. I really enjoy it.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guest, Andy Mascola, for taking the time to talk to me. And I want to thank all of you for listening and supporting my show. I've been doing this for almost a year now, which seems really hard to believe, and I'm always looking for suggestions as to how to make it better. So if you have any feedback, please email me at marissadelefarfalle@gmail.com. And please feel free to follow me on Twitter at @marissad13 or on Instagram at @marissadf13. And I'd really appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, as it'll help a lot more people find out about my show. Until next time, stay safe and peace out. This podcast has been brought to you by Anchor, which is the easiest way to make a podcast. Go to anchor.fm for more info.